This podcast is brought to you by Fresh FM, with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora, this is Tasman Report, a production of the Tasman District Council, and I'm John Bullock. In this edition, Plan Change 81, we get an update on that. Why is a community occupancy policy such a good idea? Take two. Kia ora, this is Tasman Report, a production of the Tasman District Council. I'm John Bullock. And in this edition, Plan Change 81, we get an update on that. Why is a community occupancy policy such a good idea? Dog tags for life, now there's innovation. And we head up the lake. Submissions are now open till Monday the 3rd of August for Plan Change 81, Urban Development, and Change 1 to the Tasman Regional Policy Statement. To tell us more, Jeremy Butler, Team Leader, Urban and Rural Policy.
So at kind of the headline level, the Plan Change 81 provides capacity for over 4,000 new dwellings in Tasman. It provides for around 80 hectares of business land. Another important part of the plan change, as well as just the numbers, it's really a change to a different type of housing. It's to enabling more smaller homes and housing intensification. So we're really thinking about the one and the two bedroom homes, because that's what we're short of currently, and also what we're going to need more of in the future as the population ages. And in summary there, really, this is the plan change. It's an enabling plan change. There's very little, if anything, that does any restriction. It's about enabling more and that's for the next 10 years worth of growth.
And given projected population growth and aging, vulnerable, disabled folk, how many of their houses are accessible ones?
Look, we can't absolutely require that they be accessible, but we have puts some quite strong incentives in place. And the issue here, which we're well aware of, is that as our population ages, we want people to be able to to choose their houses, to have houses to choose from, and as they get older and maybe their mobility decreases, to not have to move out of the house they're in if they choose not to, and that it's built to accommodate wheelchairs and accessibility. So we're well aware of that issue. And what we've done, and something I haven't gone into here, but there is a design element to the medium density residential zone, and it addresses some of the urban design aspects about how it looks from the outside, but also how it functions on the inside. And so we've put some quite strong incentives, and this is in order for people to developers to get the benefit of the most enabling rules. They have to show how they're going to achieve these outcomes for these homes on the inside as well. And one of the things they can do is to provide accessible homes. And so it really helps them through the rules. I won't go into the details of how that works. Happy to do so in more detail. But really, there's a strong incentive there that at least half of the homes are accessible homes. And if they do so, they get an easier way through the rules.
This is Tasman Report, and we're talking about Plan Change 81 for urban growth. So how do you go about making a submission then?
Now, online is the best way, because we've got some dedicated submission platform, a dedicated submission platform that we have available to us now, and that gives you the opportunity to go in, and the entire plan change is sort of broken up into chunks, whether that's by zoning locations or by chunks of text that are in certain sections of the plan. So you'll be able to oppose or support or recommend changes to each of those sections. So that's quite a good system, and that'll kind of keep it all structured for us. But of course, by email and post is fine as well, and we'll input that into the system. And then I guess just a few tips on writing a submission. State what you support or oppose and why. It's quite important to be specific. Any evidence that can support your submission. The last point there, I think, is an important one. We do get people who sort of say that they're concerned about something or they don't agree with something, and that's fine. But it's important to say what you'd prefer. What does that mean? What do you want done about it? What is the outcome that you would be happy with? And that can be anything from just throwing out the whole plan change. That's what you want done. That's fine. Right through to quite a specific change. So yeah, that's just an important message. It's good to raise issues, but it's also important to say what you think is the right thing that should be done about that with regards to the plan change. And then lodging your submission, all the kind of usual channels online. If you go to Shape Tasman, there's access in there. Emailing through to Environment Plan. If you've got more questions or you want any more help, who can I ask? So at that same email address, you can email through to us there at environmentplan@tasman. We'll also have, during the submission period, we'll have kind of a duty policy planner on available as well. So if you ring the council number and ask for someone in environmental policy or relating to Plan Change 81, we'll make sure there's someone there who's available for you to talk to with any specific questions. Obviously, they're not going to be able to tell you, you know, what to submit or help in any, you know, really specifically, but they can give you advice. And then if you want specific advice, you know, for your situation, then of course there's consultant planners who are available who can do that work for you as well, and they can give you advice and prepare a submission for you.
It was Jeremy Butler, Team Leader, Urban and Rural Policy, telling us about Plan Change 81, for which submissions are now open through to Monday the 3rd of August. It's all on Shape Tasman, and links are in the show notes. And joining us now is Policy Advisor Kat Budai to talk about the Community Occupancy Policy, which is about to streamline the whole administration for many of our community facilities.
So community occupancy is when a community group uses council-owned land or buildings to carry out its activities. And this could be things like sports clubs, toy libraries, museums, other non-for-profit organisations that provide maybe a social or recreational opportunity within the district. And so we offer this either through a lease or a license to occupy. And these are usually at a fairly low cost to support the community wellbeing factor. The current arrangements that we have developed over many years and are not consistent. That's one of the key problems that we're trying to address and solve with this new policy. At the moment, we have very similar groups who are paying quite vastly different fees. There's different responsibilities for maintenance and the upkeep of these buildings. There's a big mix of lease terms. Some of the groups are being on-charged for their rates and others are not. At the moment, it's completely unfair, and that's the problem that we're trying to solve. We've heard from community groups that they want clearer and more simple fees and some better communication, and so those are the some of the things that we're trying to address. So we're proposing a simpler system where instead of having what we call a cost-plus model where there's a base rent fee and then there's on-charging of rates and things like that, it's called a gross lease instead. You don't have two separate fees. You know exactly what you're going to get charged every year. And so it's much more simple to administer for both the groups and for the council at the other end. And instead of tying it to what the rates are, it would now be scaled for the size of what's being of the occupied area where the group might have exclusive use. So what they're paying for is not the council services necessarily, it's for the exclusive occupation of an area that would otherwise be available to the public.
For members of groups and on committees, just having this all tied up and rather seamless is going to be good in terms of saving time and an understanding of roles and responsibilities.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that better clarity all round has only got to be a good thing. One of the other things that we've been trying to make clear when we've been going around the district and talking to different community groups about how this might affect them is that what we're consulting on, there's really two parts to it. One is the method and that we've come up with, which is scaling things by size. And that's what's going to get set in the policy. Another separate question to consider is how much those fees should be. And that won't get set until the schedule of fees and charges gets adopted in June next year. So at the moment, we've gone out with a formula that is basically designed to try and recover a similar amount. In actual fact, it recovers less than we currently do. But it's distributed more equitably across the groups. We're still seeking feedback on that. This is a really good chance for us to test the waters, find out what kind of an impact that would have, because for some groups it means that they're decreasing in their fees, but for other groups we recognise that there is an increase as well. So we're testing the waters, but we're going to reconsult again before anything gets finalised. The other thing to make sure everyone understands is that nothing will change with current lease agreements. those are a legal document, they're binding. These changes would only start to roll over as lease agreements came up for renewal or a new lease was being signed.
Okay, and people can find out more and make a submission on Shape Tasman.
Absolutely, we welcome it.
That was policy advisor Kat Budai talking about the community occupancy policy, which is open for submissions right now through till the 9th of August on Shape Tasman. We're making dog registration a little more positive with the introduction of life tags, durable stainless steel registration tags designed to last for your dog's lifetime. Instead of receiving a new plastic tag each year, your dog will keep the same tag and unique number for life. It's a simple change that means fewer hassles for owners, less waste heading to the landfill, and a better way to help reunite lost pups with their humans. Taryn Palmer has more.
We're talking dogs today, more importantly, dog registration, dog collars, a new way of doing things with Tasman District Council. I'm talking to Shannon Green. Shannon, what's your job at council?
I'm the team leader for community compliance.
Right, so that means that you deal with the dogs?
The dogs, yep.
Okay, well, one of the many things
we do, yeah.
We've changed things up a bit this year, and we're going to a thing called life tags for dogs for registration. What's a life tag and how does it work?
The life tag that we've chosen to go with is it's a 1.5 mil roughly thick stainless steel tag. It's fibre engraved, so it's actually etched into the metal. It's about a bit smaller than the old disc tags used to be, the plastic ones. Far more durable than the plastic.
And this sticks with the animal for life?
Yeah, yeah. You get one tag and it stays with the dog for the rest of its life.
But you have to register it each year. So how does that work? How does that system work out?
So think of it like your number plate for your car. The number plate's the same on your car every time, but you still have to pay your retro. If you come in, you pay your council registration. We don't have to give you a new tag every year. We don't have to post it out to you. Once you've got it, it's with your dog for the rest of your dog's life.
Keeps plastic out of the landfill?
Keeps plastic out of the landfill. And it saves time, money, effort. No more lost tags in the post every year.
So we've still got a few things that we have to stick with, though, and the stuff under the Dog Control Act where you've got to register your dog every year. What about microchipping? That's still part of the deal? I mean, that hasn't changed, anything like that?
No, nothing in that Act has changed or the primary legislation. It's all the same. The only thing that's changing is the tag. So non-working dogs still need to be microchipped, and we do that down at the pound for free. So you give us a call, we can come in any time, or we do a microchipping clinic on Friday mornings as well from 10 to 12.
And that's at the Pound and Beach Road?
Yeah, yeah.
In Richmond?
Richmond, and if you're a Tasman resident, it's free.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So these tags, you've got a tag there that's for life. How does the dog ranger check it?
So the number that's assigned to the tag and to your dog for the rest of its life is also registered in the National Dog Database. So it can be checked by any council to make sure that you're the owner and who, where you are and your contact details. And we can check that on our cell phones and stuff issued by council.
Yeah, that's cool. Righto. So let's run it through again, just to get it absolutely clear. Plastic tags are out, those ones that change colour every year.
Yep, they're gone.
Yep. So people about now will be getting stuff, a letter in the mail, yep, reminding them of registration. What's the process?
They'll get a letter in the mail or an email, depending on how you've opted to receive it. Same process as always. You can pay online. And we'll process your and return the form to us digitally. If you've got a digital version, we can come into a council service centre and pay your rego. We'll give you a new life tag over the counter. If you do it online, we'll send it out to you, same way we did with the plastic ones. Once you've got it, that's it.
Bingo, jingo, dead easy.
That's it.
Yeah, that's good. Any particular messages to get out to? Oh, registration fees. They haven't changed this year, have they?
Not at all.
No, so they're exactly the same as last year?
Exactly the same as last year.
Just off the top of your head, how do those rules work for registration for your dogs?
So we've got Category 1, which is over 1 hectare of land. What was called the rural feed previously has changed to Category 1. It's $90. Category 2, which is under a hectare of land, or what was called urban, is $70. And working dogs, which are kept for the primary purpose of working stock, $50.
Brilliant. Shannon Green, thank you very much.
That was Darren Palmer with a great news of innovation there, especially for dog owners and dogs. Tags for a lifetime. This is Tasman Report. and I'm John Bullock. A favourite pastime, I know, for many of us is a visit to the bookstore. And most likely when you've been there recently, you would have seen a book called Up the Lake, about Lake Rotowiti. The images are stunning. The narrative, well, that clicks you up on a journey through nature and an introduction to the people of the lake. Author Annette Walker joins us now to talk about her book and why she picked up the pen on the story. But just before we get underway, I've got to tell you, Annette is a colourful story in herself, with a career at the Natural History Museum in London. She was assistant director of the International Institute of Entomology, and her interest in insects had her travel all around the world. So what was it that flicked the switch and right up the lake?
Probably the name. Why was it, when the village, why there was a village there, that really I found, and even now I'm still not quite sure why the village. I mean, who would, out in the middle of nowhere, would design a village with a sewage system, a courthouse, all the things that, you know, in the early days. So it was designed for habitation of quite a what would you say, a compact village out in the middle of nowhere. And as far as I could make out, the main emphasis to design at the village was to do with a railhead that was going to go down the, up through the Rainbow and down to Hurunui, and the traffic was going to, the horrendous voyages by sea would be superseded with this railway.
At the time of establishing the village, was farming and things like that going on in the area?
No, there was nothing. That was the weird thing. There was absolutely nothing, except John Kerr was starting to, he was very much a big influence at that stage. And he was up in the Rainbow with his first lease for growing sheep. And then because the weather in the winter was so horrendous up there, he brought his cattle and his sheep down onto the flats, the Buller Flats, which he called Lake Station. And so he was really the only person in the area at the time.
And from there, how long did it take for people to catch on that this was a great place to have a batch, for example?
Oh, not till the 50s. Not till the 30s, really. Because what happened was there was no road access. So the rail access didn't happen. Horrendous place to, you had horse and cart, so they did have some tracks. They were following old Maori trails at that stage. So there was an entrance to Lake Rotowiti from the Buller, and there was an entrance to Lake Rotowiti from Top House. And then it was by horse. And then there was a cart road on top of that, and then in the 20s, when cars became available, cars came down to the lake. And that's when the expansion started.
Does the book, tell us about the sort of the time span for the book. Does it start like at zero point, the beginning of creation? Yeah.
It does in a way, because it starts with Gondwana. So I introduced the geology of the book, in the book, because it has Rotowiti is in a unique position where it has the representatives of Gondwana, and that is reflected in the insects that I talk about in the book. So we've got very early evolution representing itself there. And then we have the glacial ice age and what happened there. But, you know, we've got the whole gambit, and eventually the big glacier that ground out Lake Rotowiti itself. So that's all in the second, well, the first chapter, really. We start with the geology.
So does nature, is that the spine of the book? Does that get carry all the way through?
Yes. There's a ongoing reflection towards nature all the way through. I mean, that's because of my my background, really. And then it is expanded at the end, because the last two chapters are about all the scientific research that's gone on up there that nobody really appreciates, just what's happened there. The design of darts that are used all over the world now, knocked down for animals and stuff in zoos, that all started up here at Lake Rotowhiti.
Well, now you've got me really interested here. What else? It seems to have a great tradition of families. You know, once they established themselves, there was some kind of house they've stayed there, is it?
They first started, they didn't have the batches, but they built boat sheds down on the beach. That was the first thing. And then the boat sheds became places where, you know, there was a bit of a worry where they could stay overnight. Yeah. And then because this town plan was all there, they started to buy some plots of land. So they moved out of their boat sheds and built batches. And the reason why they could do that was, A, there were cars now entering the lake. And also, during the Depression, which goes back to my father's day, there were these workmen cottages all scattered around from this Depression, when they were road building in sort of out-of-way places. And my father, they moved two workmen's cottages up into the bush and somehow cobbled them together. And that's the batch that we still have up there today.
Down on the lake itself, that's where you go to get the jet boat to go up the top, there is a place there where the Maori used to have an encampment there on their walk,
yes,
as you say, from one side of the island to the other.
Yeah.
There's still evidence of that there, isn't there?
Yes, you know where the car park is, where the toilets are, unfortunately. How they got away with that, I've no idea. But there's a massive midden site there, where the main food source was mussels from the lake. So all the mussel shells are underneath those mounds that you kind of drive around now. So they've carefully designed the car park where these mounds are. Well, they're there for a purpose because they're sheltering huge big midden sites.
So a little controversy here, the name. So some refer to it as St. Arnold, and the preference is to move towards Lake Rotowhiti. In your view?
The first name of the village was Lake Rotowhiti, and that's on that original town plan. I've just realised, I'm looking now at it, 1864 was the first town plan, and it was called the Village of Rotowhiti. So all I'm thinking of, well, why don't we revert back to its original name? It was changed because there was some confusion with Rotowhiti in the North Island. So they took the name of the St. Arnold Range. Now, in those days, it was a very autocratic post and telegraph department, and they just decided to do it. A total uproar amongst the farming community and the few batch owners, but mainly the farming community. They wanted Rotowhiti. And also, St. Arnold was pointed out by my colleague, Dumbleton, that he was a rogue, an absolute rogue. And I won't go into the detail. It's in the book if you want to read it. But he was in the French Foreign Legion and did some pretty horrible things.
So is there a movement to get a name change, or will there be some kind of compromise here?
We applied to Paul Benjamin, who's who did most of the final editing of the book. From a scientific point of view, I digress here a bit, but I'm a scientific writer and I find it incredibly difficult to be all those adjectives, words, we're taught to leave those out, and I found it very difficult to organise the book in a way that would be readable, and Paul helped me a lot on that. And he suggested, well, we kind of did it together. Why not see if we can resurrect that name, make sense somehow? That was the original name. So we applied to the Geographic Board. Anybody can apply to have a name change. And they've been extremely helpful. There was a total uproar in the village, which surprised me no end, but I think I got to the bottom of it really over... The name Sundano is now considered a quaint alpine village. You know, that's really what it's about. It's become a marketing name, dare I say it.
So do you think it is possible we will...
Yeah, we're in the middle of it now, so I don't know quite where it's going to go. But we have suggested through immense amount of consultation over a year that it can be a dual name. A Geographic Board apparently doing this a lot, so you can use legally either name.
The village has, of course, the chapel.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
The chapel, there was a man called Oxnam, who was a policeman of some character. He had a very forceful character. He decided that the village needed, first of all, an education centre. He was very worried about kids running riot. He'd come across a lot of kids, and he felt that kids needed to know about the outdoors. So he raised money, a huge amount, from all these Rotary and all these voluntary clubs, and they built the outdoor education centre up there. That was the first thing. But he had money left over, and he had timber left over. So he thought, well, we've looked after the kids, let's look after our souls. So he decided to build that chapel. And obviously he got a lot of support for it. And, you know, they did all sorts of things that are kind of done nowadays. Say, you bought a pew. And being a very non-religious person myself, I refused when my family wanted us to contribute as children towards the pew, and I refused. And there was some words said from my father. In the end, I had to agree.
When you go to the lake yourself, what's the favourite thing you like doing?
I sit nowadays. If the weather's fine, I love the smell of the honeydew on the beech trees. I mean, Niall Marsh talks about that marvellous smell, and it's so true up there. So I do quite a lot of... I've digressed a bit at the moment, but I often take my camera up, and a lot of the books, they used a lot of my images in the book. I walk around with the camera quite a lot. I'm a pretty disabled, ancient old body now, so I can't climb and do things that I used to do. There's nothing wrong with sitting in the sun and reflecting and listening to the birds.
That was Annette Walker talking about her book, Up the Lake, the story of Lake Rotowiti. Many fantastic chapters and stories like that of the Chapel of Christ, revealing so much about the people and the place that make Lake Rotowiti so special. And just before we wrap this episode, a thought for our residents who have backyard poultry or birds. The time is now to make sure you have protective measures in place to protect your flock when considering the possibility of bird flu. I've put links in the show notes to the Ministry of Primary Industries. Their website is great for resources about what to do. And if you see three or more sick or dead wild birds together, report them to the Ministry for Primary Industries. The number is 0800 80 99 66. Details in the show notes. And avoid touching or handling sick or dead birds. That's really important. You've been listening to Tasman Report, produced by the Tasman District Council. I'm John Bullock. Matiwa.
This podcast was brought to you by Fresh FM, with assistance from New Zealand On Air. Other great local podcasts are available through our website, freshfm.co.nz.